All right, we're going to look at, again, another continuing on in our study in Genesis. But before we get to the Genesis passage, I'd like to have us take a look at, see if I can do the, which way do we go on this one? There we go. Look in Acts chapter 7, and you say, what are we going to, why Acts? Well, it's kind of interesting. If you've never read through this passage, it's quite a long chapter, but it's the what some would call the Sermon of Stephen. Stephen was one of the first called deacons in the church at Jerusalem. It says that he was a man of the Holy Spirit, full of the Holy Spirit, and did mighty signs amongst the people. He attracted the attention of the Jewish leaders, and they even had Jewish leaders that came from other parts of the country into Jerusalem, basically to try to put down this renegade group of Christians, and of course they focused on Stephen. And he's before this group of this tribune, the tribunal of the Jewish leaders, and so it's really his defense speech. They've accused him of speaking against the fathers, Moses and Abraham, and those that were the people that were held in quite high esteem by the Jewish people, and rightly so. But again, it was false accusations. And so Stephen gets up and he starts preaching. But so we're going to look in chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. And as we read through these 10 verses, notice that he summarizes what we have been studying in our class over the past 14 months. And he says it in 8 verses. Okay? He has a way with the words. Of course, we've been looking at a lot of the detail that fills in behind the scenes, but there's even some things here that I think are interesting in these verses. So read with me or follow with me as we read, and I'm reading from the New American Standard in verses 1 through 10. We see that, and the high priest said, are these things so? In other words, the accusations about his bad-mouthing the Jewish forefathers. And he, Stephen, said, hear me, brethren and fathers. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran, and said to him, depart from your country and your relatives and come into the land that I will show you. Then he departed from the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. And from there, after his father died, God removed him into this country in which you are now living. Talking to the leaders of the Jews. Where we're standing today is where Abraham ended up. And he gave him, this is God, gave Abraham no inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground. And yet, even when he had no child, God promised that he would give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him. But God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be aliens in a foreign land, and that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. And whatever nation to which they shall be in bondage, I myself will judge, said God. And after that, they will come out and serve or worship me in this place. Again, speaking to the land of Canaan. And he gave them the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. And the patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. And yet God was with him and rescued him from his afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all his household. Those two verses, 9 and 10, just summarize what we have started in Genesis 37, and excluding Genesis 38, also tell about what happens in 39, 40, and 41. So here you have it in two verses. Okay. Now, I want to back up a little bit in this passage and have you take a look at verse 5. I thought it was kind of interesting that even though it doesn't say so explicitly in our accounts that we've been looking at in Genesis, Stephen adds a little bit of insight that, you know, he was no slouch when it came to Jewish history. To be able to, I'm sure he wasn't working from notes, because he was called before the tribunal and probably didn't have a whole lot of time to prepare for his defense. So I'm sure that most of what was spoken here in chapter 7 was coming from his memory and what God was bringing to his mind and to his lips as he was sharing with these leaders. But verse 5, and he, God, gave Abraham no inheritance in it, in the land, not even a foot of ground. I thought that's kind of interesting that Stephen points out that while Abraham was in and out of the land, you know, that he kind of moved around for a while, but God had promised to Abraham and to his descendants this land, and yet Abraham had nothing, not even a foot of ground. And if you remember, when Abraham buried his wife Sarah, they bought some property from one of the natives of that area. And then later, Isaac was buried in that area. And then after Jacob came out of Egypt with Joseph, and their bones were carried out of Egypt to back to this place to be buried. But I had never really given it a lot of thought until I reread this passage, how that Abraham had no part, no ownership in the land in which he was going to be promised, or his family was promised. Then also another comment that I'd like to make while we're looking at this passage is that the summation of what we're going to look at today in verse 8 and 9 of this passage talks about the jealousy of the brothers, of the patriarchs. And it's interesting that Stephen says these patriarchs were jealous of their own. Although Joseph was a patriarch, the rest of them were jealous of him. And that sums up what we're going to be talking about in our passage today. So continuing on, or going back then to, I guess what I wanted to point out was that God, also in this passage, in verses 6 and 7, Stephen's relating that God had told Abraham that his offspring were going to be captive in a land, which is Egypt, and there was going to be a 400-year span that offspring would be aliens in that land. And so Stephen is setting the prerequisite here for why Joseph needed to go to Egypt. God was preparing the means to get Abraham's offspring into Egypt so that after several hundred years, he would bring that nation out of Egypt. And so then that brings me to the question, had not Abraham been in Egypt? I mean, when God is talking to Abraham and saying, I'm going to bring this mighty nation out of Egypt, out of this land, what's with this, why wait so long? Because Abraham was in Egypt at one point also, wasn't he? What was the incident that caused Abraham to be in Egypt? There was a famine, and this was right after he had gotten to Haran. At least it was in the same chapter, Genesis chapter 12, and there was a famine, and so Abraham took his entourage and moved down to Egypt, and of course we know the story of that was where he said Sarah was his sister, and then they got chased out of Egypt. Well, that would have been a good time for God to have let Abraham stay in Egypt and then bring his people out. Now, how about Isaac? Was there a similar instance with Isaac with a famine? A little bit later, chapter 26. But what about Isaac? Did he get into Egypt? He was headed to Egypt, but remember, God said, don't go to Egypt. And so he ended up having the same sort of incident, but with, what was it, Abimelech? Where he said his sister, or his wife, Rebekah, was his sister. But he wasn't in Egypt. Now, here's a case where, let's see if I can... If God was going to bring the offspring out of Egypt, why didn't Abraham stay, or why didn't Isaac go to Egypt? What's that?
It wasn't time yet.
Well, it wasn't time yet, right. we can look back on that, but let's stop and think about the possibilities a minute relative to the family. Abraham came from the Ur, spent time in Haran, or in the area of Haran, and then migrated to what was Canaan. And he brought with him Sarah. Now, what happened when their son Isaac needed a wife? They went back to Haran to get a wife. Then they had children, and one of them married from the local area, and one of them didn't. Where did the second son get his family, or start? Back in Haran. Now, I don't have any proof, but think about building the family that was going to become a nation of Jewish people, of a unique people, of a Hebrew people. Right now, we have Abraham going into, or if we go back to Genesis 12, and Abraham went into Egypt, where would Isaac probably have gotten his son?
Egypt.
Or his wife, not his son, his wife, from Egypt. And then if Isaac had moved into Egypt during the famine, where would his sons probably have gotten their wives? Egypt. Now, we know that we've looked at some examples of God using Gentile people to be part of his promise, to be part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. But when we look at those instances, there is already a bloodline of people, or of a group of people, that has become the Hebrew people. Now, I'm just kind of assuming that there was a reason that God was using the reaching back into the Haran area to a group of people that were already somewhat related, so that he's building a group or a family that is of a certain blood, if you want to say. Now, in Genesis 46, it says, it gives a list. Now, you don't have to go look there right at the moment, but in Genesis 46, we'll get there eventually. The Jacob's family is moving to Egypt. Now, by that time, it's listing all the sons of Jacob, or the sons of Israel. We don't have any place that I can find where it tells who those sons of Jacob married. I'm assuming they probably came mostly from the Canaan area, because if we study our timeline that we were using for the life of Jacob and the time that he was in Padan Aram, and then moving into the area around Shechem, and as we said, probably stayed there for about 10 years and then moved a little farther south, we're still talking about fairly young men that are part of the family of Jacob. And of course, Joseph was 17, and we'll see that when he went into Egypt and married an Egyptian. Now, it's interesting that two of the tribes of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, come from Joseph, who has introduced the Egyptian bloodline. So I'm just kind of doing a little bit of thought process here of where some of these families are coming from. The families that were back in Canaan at the time probably were being developed, or wives taken and sons born to people, the wives that were taken from that particular area. So we are starting to see other nations or other people come into the family that creates the bloodline that became the Hebrews. But there was some, if you want to call it this, some strong stock to start with. Okay, I think that was part of, as Millie said, it wasn't time yet. God was using this time of building the stock that would become Israel. And then the time that they are in Egypt, if you think about why go to Egypt, and I might be taking a little bit ahead of when Pastor Bill gets to this, or whoever, when we get to that part, why go to Egypt to build the nation? Well, you look at what has happened to the people of Abraham in the Canaan area. When you study what we've looked at so far and what we're going to look at here even today, they didn't stick around in one place too well. But once they get to Egypt, they're given an area called Goshen. And when you talk about even 400 years later, when we look at the issue with the plagues and the God protecting Israel during the time of the plagues, it talks about the area or the land where Israel was, the Goshen area, didn't experience the plagues. And so somehow, maybe it was the Egyptians, kept the Israelites all in one area. And when they came out of Egypt, it says that, and this is in Exodus 12, there were 600,000 men, not counting women and children. Now, it doesn't take much of a mathematician to figure out that could probably be a couple million people. So God used that time in Egypt to build a nation. And when they went into the land of Canaan, they were already a nation, a people, and strong enough that they could do what God wanted, or should have been able to do what God wanted, and that is clear out the Canaan area of all the evil idol worshipers and start a new country, a new nation that was, should have been, pure followers of Jesus, or of God. And, of course, starting the line from which Jesus came. Okay, now, I'm sure Pastor Bill wasn't intending me to go to that extent from Acts, but you'll just have to deal with it. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 37. Now, we're going to probably spend most of the rest of the time just reading this passage. We're going to read from verses 12 through the end of the chapter. It's basically commentary on what happened. I will have a few things to say, but let's start with verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Now, I don't know about you, but if any of you grew up in a family where you had siblings, you probably had a sense of how the reaction was between certain siblings, between yourself and others. If you didn't live with, if you didn't have other siblings, if you were an only child, I'm sorry. It brings a whole new dynamic to a family situation. But I imagine Joseph knew how his brothers felt. And yet he is willing to do what his father told him. And remember, we're looking at, as we look at Joseph over these years, it might be a year if we look at Joseph, but we've been since April of 2014 that we've been studying Abraham and the family, so Joseph's got a lot of info here. But Pastor Bill has already started laying out some comparisons between Joseph and Jesus. And Jesus knew, when he came to his family, the Jewish people of Israel, they were not going to like him. And yet he did what the Father asked him to do and went to take the message. Okay, verse 15. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." Then the man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They were at Hebron, or origin of Hebron in this area. And he went to Shechem first, which is about 50 miles. And then from Shechem on to Dothan was about another 15 miles. So you might say, why are the brothers tending flocks that far away? Well, one commentator suggests that they are plotting the revenge of the people of the area who defiled their sister. Several Sundays back, we looked at the how Shechem defiled Dinah, and remember, when the writer of the book is writing, things aren't necessarily in chronological order. So while we looked at the issue of their plot against the people of Shechem, it may not have, what we're reading here may have been the prelude to that. In other words, they may have been using that as an excuse to be up in that area and tending their flock. Another possibility that I'm thinking of is that maybe they still had herds in that area from the time that they spent when they were returning from Padan Aram. Remember, they came from up in the Padan Aram area, came through this area, and then spent about 10 years, we looked in one of our lessons, about 10 years in the area around Shechem. Now, if you've got masses of herds and flocks and caretakers, and your household is not just the immediate family, it's probably also the persons that take care of the goats, and a group that takes care of the sheep, and a group that takes care of the camels, because a sheep herder isn't going to have the same expertise that a camel herder does. And so who knows what they may have done, and moving on farther south, maybe it was a convenient area to pasture a group of the herd or whatever. And now maybe the brothers are going back up there to check them. I don't know. I don't have a good answer. for why they were that far away from their father. But they were. And now Joseph was going to go look for them. Okay, verse 18. And when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." Now, again, we've had some sibling rivalries. And by the way, my sister and her husband are here visiting from Iowa. They're sitting over here with Kathy, Linda, and Lyle. And she's smiled when I said something about sibling rivalries. Us that are the older, her and I are the two oldest in the family, and we have a brother that it was constantly said, "Mom and Dad like him best." Right? Yeah, okay. See, I wasn't just my... But anyway, I don't think any of us ever got to the point where we were willing to kill one of our brothers or sisters.
Well, you might want to rethink that.
you have some new insight from me.
Our children.
But think about this. You know, here it's written down for all the world to see what kind of attitude were in the hearts of this members of this family. True, they came from different moms, but they had the same father. And that was the big thing in that culture. You know, that what's your father's? And when you look at the generations that are listed in the passages we're looking at, and those coming up, it talks about the sons and the sons of the sons. And so the father heritage or lineage is the big thing. And these guys, they didn't give a hoot. It was, "We don't like this guy, and we're going to kill him." Now, I don't know if Joseph had that kind of understanding of the hatred that his brothers had towards him. But remember, Jesus did, when he came, you know, comparing Joseph to Jesus, when Jesus came into the world, when he became a man, when he came to his own and his own received him not, he knew they were going to kill him. That's quite a ominous thing to think about, you know, going into that situation. And they said, verse 21, "But Reuben, who was the oldest, heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not take his life.' Reuben further said to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit.'" And by the way, the pit, some translations might say cistern. It's a place in the land, in the desert areas or in the pasture areas where the herdsmen would, or whoever was working the areas, would dig holes in the ground. And when the rains would come and they'd have the times of good rains, heavy rains, the water would be funneled into these pits, to these cisterns, to reserve them for the days that they didn't have a lot of water. So it's very common. It may have been a well. Sometimes the term cistern or pit or well are used interchangeably, but here's a case, and it even tells us that there was, later on it says there was no water in it. Verse 23, "So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead." Now again, here they have just been plotting to kill their own brother. Their oldest brother changed their minds a little bit, but they still cast him into the pit to try to and they have the peace of mind to sit down and have a meal. You know,
What's
that?
What's love got to do with it?
What's love got to do with it? Okay, well, a little bit of commentary or thought into the minds and the hearts of these brothers. And so, keep this in mind when we get to the passage later on in the studies, when we're looking at the brothers that come to Egypt and then learn who is handing them the food. Put this kind of thought today and merge it with what they probably are what's going through their minds then.
And it's no wonder that that their father sent Joseph to go check on them.
He probably knew that they may not be trustworthy.
Yeah.
Now, remember, now this time Israel's, it's Israel. You notice in the passage in verse 13, it's not Jacob anymore. What was Jacob? What was the meaning behind the word Jacob?
Deceiver.
Yeah. And it takes one to know one. So he probably knows that they're not always that trustworthy. And then also when we get to the end here in the passage, notice what they do, the brothers. Anyway, now the caravan's coming from Gilead, and Gilead is it's east of the Jordan. It's an area, not particularly a city, but an area that was east of the Jordan River, which was right here. So they could have been coming from anywhere over here, and they were now going to be passing across the Jordan, maybe a good place to get across to the side of the land where they could then traverse on down to Egypt. And so they're seen coming, and the brothers are conniving. And it says that they were coming with their camels, bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, now this is the third son. Reuben was number one, then it was Simeon, and Judah was number three. Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listened to him. And then the next verse says, then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now the moving back and forth between the term Ishmaelites and Midianites, Ishmaelites came from who?
Ishmael.
And who was the son of Abraham and Hagar. Okay. Keeping all the women's names straight sometimes tough for me, but Abraham and Hagar, and then the Midianites were people who were from Abraham and Keturah, his second wife. So they also lived in an area that was... So Ishmaelites and Midianites could have been interchangeable. They could have been used, their same type or from the same area. So it may have been some of both with the group. It may have been just a vernacular term, you know, saying, well, these were Ishmaelites, and they were coming from Midian area. So it's not really what you would call an error or a mistake in the scriptures, as some might want to make it out to be. Okay, then we go back to verse 29. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So Reuben evidently hadn't been part of the scheme to sell him. Maybe he had intended to rescue him and bring him back to his father and somehow maybe get some good graces with his father again. But now he finds that he's not in the pit, and he tore his garments. Well, you know, my plan's been thwarted. I don't know, maybe I won't get back in the good graces with my father, and I'm going to be, who knows? But anyway, he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I going to go?" That kind of gives a little indication that, if I don't have this to fall back on, I might be hung out to dry. But so they took, they told him, "Oh, no, don't worry. He's okay. We sold him. He's gone. He's out of our hair." But they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." We didn't lie. We're not lying, but look at it. What do you think? Yep, that's Joseph's. And it says that he examined it and said, "This is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." And the brothers are quiet. They aren't going to tell what they've done, but their little deceit has taken root. They're off the hook for the moment. And again, keep this in mind. When we get to the passage where Joseph and his brothers meet and their father, think about what the brothers now have to relate to their father. Joseph's still alive. How did he get down here? When we get to that passage, keep this part in mind. And then all of his sons, so Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all of his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol or to the grave in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. And we're going to, the next chapter is about Judah's shameful sin, which I'm not sure. I'm sure, Pastor, we're going through this book by book, so I'm sure he'll deal with it. But until next time, chapter 39, when we pick up the story of Joseph, just remember what we read in chapter 7 of Acts. And it says that God was with him and rescued him from all his afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his household. So Stephen talks about Joseph and totally skips over all the next three chapters that we're going to be looking at and the issues that Joseph had to deal with when he first got to Egypt. And Stephen's comment is God was with him and raised him up. You know, that sometimes it's tough for us to see the things in our lives that are the difficult areas, but God sees it from the standpoint of God was with us and God raised us up. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, but we definitely have the eternity to look forward to.
That's right.
Our Heavenly Father, I thank